This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Mitch Teich. This week, during our Project Milwaukee series, we're spending time talking about wellness and aging, specifically how the steps people can take throughout their years affect their quality of life in the years to come. In a few minutes, we'll discuss planning that 20-somethings can make for a future that seems a lifetime away, but we start today in the latter third of our lives. Of all the question marks about aging, the one that frightens many people the most is the loss of their mental facilities. Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia are becoming more common, especially as Americans live longer. But strategies to stave off cognitive decline are also increasing, and today there's some optimism that the mental decline of old age need not be a rapid phenomenon. Ann Basting and Tom Fritsch have both done significant work on the cognitive challenges of aging in their roles at the Center on Age and the Community at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Basting is the director of the center and Fritsch the associate director, and they join us in the studio now. Welcome to both of you.
That's a pleasure.
You're welcome.
In all the attention about medical issues that an aging population faces, do you think cognitive issues get short shrift, or are people coming around to the issue?
Well, I think that cognitive impairment, which is another way of saying memory loss, which is in some ways a very natural part of aging, is probably one of the most feared things in the aging process in our country. And I think it's for multiple reasons. I think that we are a hyper-individualistic culture, and the concept of losing yourself, that you've spent your entire life organizing and arranging and working toward, is horrifying. And, it is frightening. But I think also the reason that it is so feared is we do such a lousy job in caring for people with memory loss. And so it becomes a much more feared thing than it needs to be.
Let's talk about you, because you said in some ways it's a natural part of aging, but I gather there are different degrees of memory loss that we're talking about here. So give us a sense for what is a natural part of aging that we probably can't do anything about and what we can do something about.
Well, sure. There are different degrees of memory loss, and to some extent, all of us will experience as we age some noticeable changes in our cognitive abilities, our abilities to think and remember, and that can be distressing, but not necessarily a harbinger of worse things to come. The prevalence of what we call subjective memory complaints is about 25% to 50%. Of people report that.
And let me stop you there and ask you to describe what a subjective memory complaint is.
Well, that's the feeling that something's not quite right, that you may be having memory problems, and that's often driven by, I think personally, by a fear that, oh boy, I see something changing and what's to come in the next 10 years. So it's this subjective personal feeling that, I've never been tested before, but I think that my memory is changing. And indeed, some of the normal changes in memory and cognition are changes in the speed of processing, how quickly you can think about processes. Another thing that changes is your ability to find words, as I'm currently experiencing right now. And then there are, of course, changes in memory. And I think if you look at the statistics, you can see that there is indeed an increasing prevalence of severe memory impairments. But as Anne has pointed out, despite these increasing trends over time, there are avenues of hope and ways that we can look more positively at this impending problem.
Are there two tracks that we're talking about? Is there a mental track and a medical track, or is that oversimplifying things? Are both things wrapped up in each other?
Well, I would say the medical and the mental are inextricably linked. We measure memory problems through neuropsychological tests, and for example, if an individual comes into their doctor and asks, am I okay? Is there a problem here? They will usually give them some sort of simple testing, and that's the initial assessment, and the doctor will then proceed from there, I think.
I spent a lot of time studying models of individual identity and memory. And when they're looking at losses and impairment, it's always on this individual model. And some people may be in very supportive environments, in very supportive relationships, in a strong social network where they may not even realize it, but their sort of memory coping skills and strategies are actually augmented by their community and their friends and their family. So they may be experiencing these things but not experiencing any stress around the losses because they're in a supportive environment. And so really, those lab models of memory loss really should have a little asterisk that says this is a lab result. This is not a real life living experience. And when you look and are assessing someone, we need to acknowledge their full life experience and how they're living. And maybe part of the treatment plan might be a pill, but part of the treatment plan might be getting the person into a more supportive environment. I think that there's a full care plan available.
Well, and so talk about some of those strategies, those activities that can play into, if not staving off memory loss entirely, certainly affecting it in a way that it isn't the same stressor as it might be to someone who isn't employing these strategies.
Well, one of the things that we're involved at the Center on Age and Community is a study of what's known as early memory loss clubs or memory clubs. And those are groups that are kind of emerging at a grassroots level all across Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, and really all across the country. And it's a very exciting period, I think, because of these interventions that are designed to provide some of the things that Anne was talking about. So a supportive network of individuals who are experiencing similar problems, similar concerns about their memory, and also really taking an active part in their own care by doing things like mental aerobics, brain fitness kinds of techniques, learning about ways to improve memory, and also being involved in physical, light physical activities that the research is beginning to show can have an impact on the structure of the brain and the areas of the brain that are involved in memory.
And you say you're sort of in an early part of studying this. Right now, the evidence is mainly anecdotal, and you're looking for the science?
That's correct, Mitch. If you look through the literature or Google these clubs, you'll probably find many of them out there, but if you start to then look for the empirical evidence, the scientific studies, you will find very few. And the ones that you do find are really satisfaction ratings of being in the club. So it's a good thing that people are satisfied and happy with the clubs, but we really want to know and we need to know whether these clubs are actually having an impact on cognition, memory and thinking, well-being, satisfaction, and then indirectly with the care partners, because going through the Alzheimer's journey is not just the individual who's afflicted, but it's also the context of people that are around the person. And I think that's a critical component of some of Anne's views.
I think, too, that it goes beyond just people with memory loss. I think traditionally in this country, we've had this marker of 65, and then once you hit it, you're supposed to go off into some glorious land of leisure. And a lot of people would love to do that. A lot of people don't have the resources to do it. I think it's going to be fascinating to look at the fallout of this economic situation we're in, to look at how aging is going to change, because not a lot of people are going to be able to retire who were planning on it. But what I think we're seeing in the shift of this demographic wave of baby boomers now hitting retirement age, if they aren't able to actually retire, is a real redefinition of the purpose of that phase of life. And I think that what we can do and what we're starting to do is, instead of looking at that moment as a problem, we're going to get bankrupted as a country, you know, Medicaid and Medicare, it's just awful, to look more at the sort of civic ventures model, which is, wow, we have an incredible number of retirees who are looking for meaning in their lives. let's give them opportunities for meaningful volunteerism, meaningful efforts that lifelong education, lifelong learning, partnering in intergenerational programs. We've been looking at this half glass half full for a real long time now, trying to generate, I think, an economic panic over how to deal with the aging of the baby boomers. But we have to do is look at the other half of the glass to see that it's half full. It's a real opportunity for us to reframe how we're thinking about it.
One of the other issues that people of all ages deal with is depression, but obviously depression is another story altogether when you're also talking about somebody with cognitive impairment. Does depression drive memory loss, or does memory loss drive depression?
Well, I would say from my experiences and my reading of the literature that both of those directions of causality exist, if you will, because when people are diagnosed with an illness such as Alzheimer's disease, it can cause what we call a reactive depression, so that the person realizes, oh my God, I'm in store for something that is incredibly fear-provoking.
Like with any chronic disease, really.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, if you get a cancer diagnosis, my God, how is my life going to change? But also, there are changes associated with Alzheimer's disease that cause depression. So there are neurotransmitter changes. So the chemicals that help our brain cells communicate with each other kind of decrease. And that's associated with depression often. So I think, you know, it's both ways, the direction.
And it makes it all the more complicated to deal with the depression.
I think so, too. I think that one of the other things is that we hear from people with memory loss that they may be isolating themselves so that they don't show the loss to friends and family, or that if it progresses to a point where friends and family feel awkward around it, they may cut off contact. And so people get, you know, and can get increasingly isolated, which can also feed and fuel the sense of depression. So a lot, as we've been saying, a lot of our work is about really building on the research that's been coming out, where instead of finding the magic pill, which we do not have yet, we're finding a lot of good results in building social network, rebuilding community, essentially putting people back in community in the early memory loss clubs or the early memory clubs, and in the work that I do in expression through the arts, so that you're keeping people mentally engaged, you're giving them a sense of purpose and a sense of community.
It's nice to have a discussion about social networking that does not involve the term Facebook.
don't cut it short. It might be next. You never know.
Well, and I wonder how much of the solution to this is going to be driven in part by the fact that so many more people are becoming older, that out of necessity, aging people won't be marginalized because there will be so many more of them than there are of people who are younger.
Oh, I don't doubt our ability to marginalize older people, even if they're the most numerous people in the culture. We've been aware, believe it or not, of the aging of the baby boom from the minute they were born. And we've done a really lousy job of preparing for it. In fact, we still are unprepared for it. And we talk about it endlessly, but we don't do anything about it. It's really amazing.
I was going to say that an interesting aspect, though, of the boomer generation is that they are very proactive in taking care of themselves as well. And that's really a positive, I think, in the potential onslaught of new cases of Alzheimer's disease that have been projected for the future. So when I give talks in the community about brain health and maintaining brain fitness, I often see many of the baby boomer generation. And my understanding is, or my interpretation is, that these are individuals who have throughout their lives worked for social justice, social change, and they take matters into their own hands, so that if they feel that there's some sort of program that they can be a part of, such as these early memory loss clubs, they want to know all the details about it and what they can do to empower themselves to perhaps delay some of these cognitive changes that will affect some of us, not all of us, but they're thinking preventatively, I believe.
There was a study just recently by a Yale psychologist that showed people with a positive perception of aging lived longer. Do you have a sense for what a positive perception of aging actually is?
I think it's the looking at the glass as half full, that you have a reason for being, that you have a value and a purpose and something to give to other people around you, that you're not locked in the dependency side of the dependency model, that you're actually in reciprocal relationships, and like I said, you have a value and a purpose. And I know that study, it's by Becca Levy as the lead researcher, and it was 7.5 years that we gained. And at the end of that article, she said, think about this. If there was a way to get a pill to give people that extra 7.5 years, we'd be investing millions of dollars in trying to figure it out. But because it's this thing that people assume is natural, fear and a negative perception of aging, nobody does anything about getting those 7.5 years back. But we do have a way to change those perceptions of aging. We actually can do that. And I think it's time we invest in it.
Well, Anne Basting and Tom Fritsch, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Sure, our pleasure.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Anne Basting is the director, and Tom Fritsch is the associate director of the Center on Age and the Community at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. There's a link to the center's website from ours, wuwm.com/lakeeffect.